First case is 03-1284, Beatrice Maitland, Elton J. Shaw, Dwayne Adams versus Ford Motor Company. Mr. Carpenter.
Please, the court. Good morning, Your Honors.
Carpenter, I'm representing the appellants, General Motors Corporation, Ford Motor Company, and Daimler Chrysler Corporation in this argument. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I might,
Your Honor. Watch your time there.
Your Honor, in this case, the decisions of the 10th District Court of Appeals of last June should be reversed, and the decision of the trial judge below reinstated for three reasons. First, Your Honors, the Ohio Lemon Law did not and does not preclude the use of mileage offsets by informal dispute resolution boards under Ohio Revised Code 1345.77, or stated differently, the repayment of a full purchase price is not a mandatory remedy for an informal arbitration panel under Section 1345.77 and the administrative rules thereunder. That is the first reason the decision below should be reversed. Second, Your Honor, the use of mileage offsets in trying to resolve Lemon Law disputes informally, which was the approved policy of three different Ohio attorneys general, cannot be an unconscionable, unfair, or deceptive practice by manufacturers within the meaning of the Consumer Sales Practices Act. Finally, Your Honors, the third reason why the decision below should be reversed is that the plaintiffs may not reopen the final settlements of their warranty claims. If this court does not reverse the 10th District Court of Appeals opinion, it will be effectively announcing, first, that the law of finality in settlements in Ohio is no more. Second, that reliance upon the policy, opinions, and guidance of the chief law enforcement officer of this state, the Ohio Attorney General, can be an unconscionable act or deceptive or unfair act fraught with economic peril for the law-abiding citizen.
But the statute doesn't say anything about any set-off, does it?
The statute, Your Honor, in .77 speaks directly of the plenary authority and authorization given to the Ohio Attorney General to set up resolution systems, informal dispute resolution mechanisms.
But it talks about full purchase price.
Only in .72, Your Honor, a different statutory section. Under .72, the full purchase price language that Your Honor is referring to speaks of what the consumer would be entitled to seek as a remedy in a court proceeding, not in an informal dispute resolution of process.
Has there been a change in the viewpoint of the Attorney General recently with respect to disapproving of this process of set-off?
Your Honor, in terms of the change, in the year 2000, October of 2000, Attorney General Betty Montgomery indicated that after reviewing this situation, her administration had determined that on a prospective ongoing basis, mileage offsets would no longer be permitted as part of the remedies decided by an independent arbitration board. So yes, as of October of 2000. However, from the late 1980s until that decision in October of 2000, that opinion, that revision of policy, three different attorneys general, including Attorney General Montgomery, not only found that you could have a reasonable mileage offset, but actually did the formula or calculation by which it was to be done. In other words, those attorneys generals established the formula, the numerator and the denominator, that was to be applied against the purchase price for purposes of any remedy that could be issued.
But we don't want the Attorney General saying what the law is. We should be saying what the law is. Isn't that right? Or are you suggesting that this is some discretionary authority that's been given from the legislature, delegated to the Attorney General?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That authority was clearly delegated by the General Assembly to the Attorney General.
And so your viewpoint is that the Attorney General authorized one procedure up until Attorney General Montgomery changed it, and then a separate procedure subsequent to her discretion to modify the plan.
Under the plenary authority issued by the General Assembly to the Attorney General, that was part of the supervisory mandate given to the Ohio Attorney General.
Thank you.
Your Honors, the third reason why this court, if it does not reverse the 10th District Court of Appeals, will be affecting the plain language of the statutes that are designed to promote out-of-court resolutions of disputes, and the plain language of those statutes will be rendered essentially meaningless. In this instance, the 140 years of policy of the state has favored out-of-court resolutions of disputes. I believe Justice Pfeiffer actually is the most recent statement of this in 1998 in a case by this court, in which it talked about Ohio courts favoring arbitration and the General Assembly favoring arbitration. The 10th District Court of Appeals decision, unfortunately, now finds it's impermissible for arbitrators, for an informal dispute resolution panel in an informal dispute setting, to craft a remedy of anything less than the maximum amount consumers can obtain if they prevail in their claims, not in arbitration, not in informal dispute resolution, but in court. This is wrong, and it flies in the face of the plain language of .77, which delegated to the Attorney General the right and the authority to establish a resolution mechanism. Additionally, the 10th District Court of Appeals says that settlements fostered by this informal dispute resolution process for a decade are no longer final and can be sued upon without first returning the long-ago paid settlement proceeds, and by not only accepting the benefit of those proceeds, but by proceeding with further litigation, which is the case we have before this honorable court. We referred to this in our brief as having your cake and eating it too, and that's what we believe the case is. The 10th District also ignored the fact that manufacturers and the independent dispute resolution arbitrators participated in the informal dispute resolution process in good faith reliance upon the Ohio Attorney General's rules and policies authorizing arbitrators to include a mileage offset in their remedial decisions. As I mentioned before, Your Honor, there was a formula specifically provided by the Attorney General. In addition, the Ohio Attorney General had an affirmative duty under the Consumer Sales Practices Act to not only define unconscionable acts, but also to inform suppliers if their actions were unconscionable, unfair, or deceptive. That was never done. So not only was there an affirmative duty to set up these informal dispute resolution boards and to effectuate the policy of the state, but there was also a further affirmative duty to tell us, to tell the suppliers if what we were doing was inappropriate, and to set out definitional sections under the Consumer Sales Practices Act. All 50 states in the country have passed lemon laws. A key component of every lemon law is the creation of alternative dispute resolution techniques, including mediation and arbitration. When Ohio passed its lemon law in 1987, it specifically followed that strong policy of out-of-court resolution of disputes and set them forth in section 1345.77.
And the Court of Appeals noted that an overwhelming majority of lemon law states have expressly provided for a reasonable use deduction. Ohio statute does not. And as you know, the appellee argues that we should give some weight to that. Why should we not consider that to be a dispositive argument?
The critical aspect of that, Your Honor, is that what they're referring to is section 1345.72, the statute that provides the remedy the consumers are entitled to under .75 if they go to a court of competent jurisdiction. .77 does not incorporate either .72 or .75 into its statutory framework. It is an independent statutory grant of authority. And under that .77 statute, that part of the lemon law, what we're looking for is an attempt to set up an informal dispute resolution board. And the powers for setting that up and for the effectuation and supervision aspect of that are delegated to the Ohio Attorney General. So .72, Your Honor, is important if we get to court. And the reason and why we get to court ultimately under .77 is if the consumer, who has total authority and power to accept or reject this informal dispute resolution decision, the consumer may then, if they do reject that, may go to court under .75, and .75 specifically incorporates section .72. Those are the distinctions that are very important here. Each of these stand independently with respect to the aspect of a reasonable mileage offset. When the Ohio Attorney General established these informal dispute resolution mechanisms, three of them provided that a reasonable mileage offset could be part of the decision that was rendered by this arbitration panel. Any remedy is the way the rule looks.
Were the lead plaintiffs in this case represented by counsel when they went through the informal dispute resolution process?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. I do not know that. I do not believe that to be the case. Those facts were not, however, yet developed under this motion to dismiss. The aspect of that, however, Your Honor, is that they were given an opportunity to accept or reject the decision of the arbitrators in the informal dispute resolution process. So that decision obviously was theirs to accept or reject. The goal of the informal dispute resolution process is to make it a swift process within 40 days, as opposed to dragging through the court system for a lengthy period of time. They were also told and advised as part of their decision-making process that they would be entitled to have also the right to proceed in a court of competent jurisdiction if they chose to reject the arbitrator's decision and chose to go forward. Certainly, there was nothing precluding them from having counsel present during the arbitration process or to have a counsel review their legal options at the end of that process before accepting or rejecting it. They did all accept it. And the difference is, for example, Mr. Shaw, the difference that he's claiming in this case is about $480. So we're not talking about dramatically large sums of money that were forfeited by any of these plaintiffs in order to get a swift resolution of their consumer claim. The trial judge below, Your Honor, recognized that the process was working, and he also recognized that the fact that the Lemon Law was set up by the General Assembly and was reviewed by the General Assembly in 1999 was of great moment. The Court of Appeals in the 10th District failed to realize that, and let me tell you why. This law was on the books for 10 years, State of Ohio, .77, as well as the other Lemon Laws, and in 1999, the Ohio General Assembly took a plenary, if I might use that word again, a plenary review of the Ohio Lemon Law. For 10 years, this mileage offset had been used in the alternative dispute resolution process. For 10 years, the Ohio Attorney General had been telling us, telling the boards, how to calculate what should be done with respect to reasonable mileage offsets. And for 10 years, the Ohio Attorney General had indicated that there was nothing unconscionable about this with respect to the authority provided to the Attorney General to advise us of that. When the General Assembly in 1999 took a review of the statute, it changed many of the other substantive sections. .72 that Chief Justice Moyer referred to, it was changed. Other sections were changed. The only section that was not tampered with, not modified, not altered, was .77. And this court should give deference not only to the Ohio Attorney General and the 10 years of clear policy and clear rulemaking, but should also give deference to the General Assembly, not only at the outset in 1989, when it passed the plain language of the statute, but also in 1999, 10 years later, when the Ohio legislature looked once again at the Lemon Law and determined that what had been going on for 10 years did not merit modification, alteration, or amendment. The trial judge below recognized that. They recognized that disputes were being resolved out of court, that the Attorney General's supervisory powers were being correctly applied, that the manufacturers were relying on those rules and policies in good faith, as were the arbitrators who sat for those 10 years. And then when the General Assembly, as I mentioned, reviewed the process, they left it alone.
What rule of law do you think we should announce in this case, given your argument that there's been a change in the Attorney General's authority and a change in the Attorney General's decision with respect to treating these types of matters?
With respect,
are we going to come out with two different rules of law, one that applies up to a certain point in time and then another one? Or what are you asking us to do here?
I think, Your Honor, the way this can be crafted, and I have thought a little bit about this, but you're referring to the letter change, the policy change in October of 2000 by
yes.
the Ohio Attorney General. I think that what this court needs to do is to indicate that the policies were properly applied, the rules were properly generated, properly reviewed by the General Assembly, and that the delegation of authority was properly presented and was properly exercised by the Ohio Attorney General. As part of that proper exercise, the Ohio Attorney General decided in October of 2000 that there was going to be a change in that policy, which was also within the prerogative and power under .77 of the Ohio Attorney General. I think that prospectively, what this court can hold is that the Ohio Attorney General continues to have that power, the Ohio Attorney General's exercised that authority, and that from October 2000 on, while it may no longer be part of the rulemaking authority, it is not precluded. If future Ohio Attorney Generals wish to look at this, it is not precluded by the statute or by the rule of law.
So if our current Attorney General decided to change it, then we'd have a different rule in Ohio. And it's all dependent on what the Attorney General or who the Attorney General is and what policy is announced by that office.
I think that under .77, Your Honor, provides that authority to the Ohio Attorney General for informal dispute resolution mechanisms, for the rules promulgated and the policies thereunder. We're not talking about amending the statute, the .72 aspect, with respect to the full refund in court. But when we're trying to resolve disputes out of court, and the statute has specifically provided that authority is given to the Ohio Attorney General, I believe that the Ohio Attorney General can do what that he or she believes is best for that process under that.
Thank you.
I believe, Your Honor, I'm out of time.
I think you are.
If I might just sum, I would just say we'd ask the court to reverse, and I have 3 minutes reserved for rebuttal. Thank you.
Just so you know, the red light means that 15 minutes has been expended, so you'll have 30 seconds.
30 seconds,
yes.
Rebuttal. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Chief Justice Moyer. May it please the court. John Murray from the law firm of Murray & Murray on behalf of all the plaintiffs. Pat McGuire from McGuire and Schneider here in Columbus. My co-counsel is also present. May it please the court. The appellant's argument stands four things on its head that are remarkable. First, the plain language of the statute, the Lemon Law statute. Secondly, the rulings of this court in Royster. Thirdly, three appellate decisions that are directly on point. And fourthly, the legislative history of this statute are all simply stood right upside down and on its head. I ask the court to first look at the plain language of the statute and specifically ORC 1345.72, which says, if the manufacturer, its agent, or its authorized dealer is unable to conform the motor vehicle to any applicable express warranty by repairing or correcting any nonconformity after a reasonable number of repair attempts, the manufacturer, at the consumer's option, and subject to the Division D of section of this section, either shall replace, and the emphasis here, I submit, is shall replace, the motor vehicle with a new motor vehicle acceptable to the consumer, or shall accept return of the vehicle. Those shells are absolutely mandatory in their commandments. There is no qualification, no reference to 1345.77 qualifying or limiting that remedy. And I think it's instructive to then look at the section that has been referred to by Mr. Carpenter that talks about going to court, and that is ORC 1345.75. And it specifically states that if the manufacturer fails to comply with the section of 1345.72 of the revised code, and in addition to the relief to which the consumer is entitled under that section, shall be entitled to recover reasonable attorney's fees. It is clear from the statutory construction that 1345.72 is the remedy when the manufacturer fails to comply with its requirements under its warranties. That is, in and of itself, end of this case as far as the appellees are concerned. And we believe that the court has a constitutional obligation in this case to render what the legislature has determined to be the appropriate remedy. Yes.
How do you deal with the argument Mr. Carpenter advances in his brief that your clients have settled their claims 2 years before they file a lawsuit, received ostensibly a new vehicle less the reasonable use And why isn't that an accord and satisfaction and the end of the matter? And why are your clients then entitled to relitigate what they'd already settled?
Justice O'Donnell, I'm glad you asked that question, because this is not a settlement, and there's no evidence in the record whatsoever there is a settlement. I submit to this court that these three defendants are the most sophisticated litigators in the world, and probably the most sophisticated litigators ever to before this court. If they had a release and a settlement, you would see a release and settlement agreement in this record. There was no release and no settlement. And I direct the court's attention to the documents that were sent to my clients, which says there was a decision.
That's why I asked. I thought it was perhaps an accord and satisfaction as opposed to a settlement or a release, because there aren't those documents, as far as I'm aware, in the record.
And Your Honor, the 1345-77 is very specific in how you make a settlement. And the Attorney General has issued very specific guidelines in the administrative code, and they are found at beginning at administrative code 109-4-1-1, and they spell out specifically what you have to do to have a settlement and how the process works. And then they say if there's no settlement, then you go to a decision. Amazingly absent from this is the letters that both that Attorney General Celebrezze, Attorney General Fisher, and Attorney General Montgomery have issued to these various dispute resolution organizations. There is a rulemaking process in this state. It's an administrative code. We allow public comment. The Attorney General did not use that. The Attorney General has a formal opinion process. She did not use that. And the fact that an Attorney General simply writes a personal opinion letter to a private party dispute resolution and does not obtain public comment renders her letter a legal opinion from a lawyer and no more. And the fact is that if we look at the administrative code, there's a process for settlement, and it was not followed in this case. Also, there's a process under the administrative code that says the consumer has to be given notice of, quote, the effect of this process. And that's an absolute quote, effect. There is nothing that these defendants ever did to give notice to the consumer that this was going to be a settlement offer. And the fact that the appellants have called this a settlement offer is somewhat shocking in the sense that the administrative code also states very specifically that the informal dispute resolution board needs to be independent, have no relationship whatsoever. The appellant's argument converts this independent board into a business agent negotiator for the manufacturers. That was clearly never the intent of the statute, and clearly never the intent of any of the three attorney generals that have participated in the rulemaking process. The second thing is that this court has spoken very clearly in Royster versus Toyota that at page 329 of this decision, once the deal for a new automobile is complete, however, the clear language of the General Assembly takes over. I'm going to then skip part of the quote. It requires new vehicles to live up to warranties given by manufacturers. The Lemon Law attaches a clear duty to sellers and provides a clear remedy to buyers should the seller breach its duty. I submit if this court adopts the arguments of the appellants, that clear duty and clear remedy will be simply abrogated. The consumer will be left to require to go to two different proceedings. They will now have to have an attorney, because you're going to be now setting yourself, every single case we're going to be pre-setting for litigation. It's going to encourage litigation, and that's the path we're going to go down. This was originally set up to give quick, swift, and certain justice and resolution to these problems at minimal cost. That was the idea behind the Lemon Law, and that's what we hope that this court will adopt. And we submit that the Court of Appeals got it exactly right when they said, in reference to the set-off provision, that the average consumer of a nonconforming vehicle can neither afford nor justify protracted litigation, which could easily cost more than the value of the vehicle. As a result, when faced with a choice between full refund minus a few hundred dollars or $1,000 for mileage and a protracted lawsuit with no guarantee of success, a prudent consumer would accept settlement every time. That is what we're confronting here, and we have a situation where, in the case of Mr. Adams, he had to pay $6,000 or a $6,000 set-off. And so Mr. Carpenter is correct. Some of these, with my clients, were $400, $600, but some of them are $6,000 and higher. The reality is that most of these car loans are underwater from the moment you drive the car off the parking lot.
I guess that's a question that I wonder if the states that have permitted by statute or regulation, generally by statute, for a set-off, if they have concluded that the owner of this vehicle, that turns out to be a lemon, did get some value from the vehicle, that they drove it for however many miles they drove it, is it your contention that a countervailing policy argument would be that, yes, they drove it for 6,000 miles, but it wasn't very pleasant driving. It was a lemon, and they had a lot of trouble with it, and so that's a reason to not. That's not arguing your briefs. I'm just trying to get. I'm trying to get to the policy issues here that that generate this dispute. It seems as if there are good arguments on both sides of that.
Well, I think Justice Moore would, Chief Justice Moore, which I think you're referring to, is whether or not this is fair that the consumer can keep this vehicle for 3 months, 4 months, drive it for 30,000 miles or 18,000 miles and turn it back in. That's a decision that was made by the legislature. And that's appropriate for the legislature to make that decision. And I think this court needs to defer to that legislative decision. And more importantly, this court has indicated an acknowledgement that this loan and lemon law, and I quote the court in Royster, the statute needs a harsh remedy at a time certain. Ohio's lemon law does that better than most states. The legislative history, which you asked Mr. Carpenter about, is very clear. There was a mileage deduction and mileage set off in the original draft of this statute. It was removed after debate. And that is, I think, controlling as far as the legislative history and the legislative intent. It was specifically removed. And the reason is that the consumer has other things that they may or may not be able to pursue through this process, other remedies. And this is a clean, specific remedy. And as I was about to say, these loans are underwater. This is not what is being promoted by the appellants is not good for business. It's not good for the banks. It's not good for the small car dealers. It's not good for the consumer. It's good for three entities, the defendants, the appellants in this case. The fact is that most consumers are not going to be able to pay these loans off if they don't get a full refund. And that is the policy behind why the legislature selected and went this route that may or may not be fair. And the fact that 49 states have done it a different way may or may not be fair, but it is up to the Ohio legislature to make that decision.
Let me ask you a follow-up question to a question that Justice O'Donnell raised. If there was no lemon law statute involved here and the parties settled their dispute and Ford gave your clients cars, but they said we're going to deduct the mileage from the value, and there was a settlement, not in court, and there's no entry. And 2 years later, plaintiffs file an action, not under lemon law, obviously, but file an action. How would that be treated? What would the principles of law be applied to that action?
Well, settlements, of course, are a matter of contract. And that, therefore, there has to be a meeting of the minds, and both parties have to have an understanding of the contract. And in this case, there is no such contract or settlement. If, in fact, there was a settlement or an accord in satisfaction, and it was done properly, then that would be a bar to bring any cause of action. Assuming, and I think this court has reviewed many, many settlements, a lot of case law has been developed, that unless that language is very clear about all causes of action, all choices of action, the language we're so familiar with seeing, that oftentimes causes of action survive. We don't have that here. There is no contract. What there is a decision from a board as a result of very specific administrative rules that have rules about settlement. And this is not under those rules about settlement. It's under the rules that talk about if there's no settlement, then the board will make a decision within 40 days. And that's what we're dealing with here, is a decision. And if they wanted to get a release, they should have gotten a release. The other point I would like to address is the what I call the appellant's use of what a legislative reverse option. Usually reverse options are given to consumers in mailing stuffers, but in this case, the appellants have argued that the legislature, having amended this statute in 1999, should have changed 1345-77 because they must have known about this private letter that the Attorney General has written. We submit that that makes a mockery of the entire checks and balance system and is an amazing argument in light of the fact that the Page case, which is one of the appellate decisions, was decided in 1996, and the Koppel case, which was decided in 1997, both said specifically that there will be no set-off. Set-offs are specifically not allowed under this statute. I don't think I need to remind this court that the legislature has not hesitated to write legislation to disagree with this court. And in this case, these are two published decisions. If the legislature was going to change anything, if they disagreed with it, they would have changed the statute to disagree with Page and Koppel. And I see that my time is just about up. I will, Your Honor, I will rely on the brief in regard to our Ohio Consumer Sales Practices claim. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. Mr. Carpenter, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
I will move swiftly, Your Honor. The Royster, Capel, and Page cases, with respect to no set-off, all occurred in the context of a common pleas court hearing, not in terms of an informal dispute resolution mechanism. The language that my learned opponent used in terms of shall replace and shall accept arises from .72. I have yet to hear him cite any language from .77, which is the operative statute. Justice O'Donnell asked about settling claims, accord and satisfaction. Well, the administrative rules provide specifically under 109.4-4-04 that a dispute shall be, and I'm quoting, deemed settled when the board has ascertained from the consumer his or her acceptance of the offer. So my time is up, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.